The good news and our text for preaching today comes from Matthew's Gospel. These words comprise, with the Beatitudes, the opening of what I think is the most famous sermon ever preached, and I will come back to that point in a minute. But I invite you for now to listen for God's living word to you in these words and in what follows. You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt has lost its taste, how can its saltiness be restored? It is no longer good for anything, but is thrown out and trampled underfoot. You are the light of the world. A city built on a hill cannot be hid. No one, after lighting a lamp, puts it under a bushel basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all the house. In the same way, let your light so shine before others so that they may see your good works and give glory to God in heaven. Do not think that I have come to abolish the law or the prophets. I have not come to abolish, but to fulfill. For truly I tell you, until heaven and earth pass away, not one letter, not one stroke of a letter will pass from the law until it is all accomplished. Therefore, whoever breaks one of the least of these commandments and teaches others to do the same will be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But whoever does them and teaches them will be called great in the kingdom of heaven. For I tell you, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. The word of God for the people of God. Of all the special services that we do here, Ash Wednesday, Maundy Thursday, even the back porch sessions, our Christmas Eve lessons of candles, candlelight service of lessons and carols may be my favorite. It concludes with what is, without a doubt, my favorite moment from any of these services. If you've been here on Christmas Eve, then you'll know we close the service by making a circle of light around the sanctuary, around those outer aisles of the sanctuary. We do this using the same flow that we'll use in just a few minutes to receive the sacrament of the Lord's Supper. We'll invite you to come down the center aisle, light a candle, or we do on Christmas Eve, light a candle from the candles that Beth and I are holding, and then instead of returning to your seats, this is on Christmas Eve, we'll form a ring of light that runs all the way around the sanctuary. But that's not all we do on that night. We make this ring while singing Silent Night and holding our candles. As you might imagine, it's a beautiful moment. But that moment is not just beautiful. It's also sacred, profoundly holy. It's also extremely special for me because as each person comes forward and lights their candle from mine, I think to myself, and sometimes I interrupt my singing to say this, Ray, you are the light of the world. Emily, you are the light of the world. Kristen, Allie, Evan, you are the light of the world. Now, at best, calling members of my congregation the light of the world would be presumptuous if this claim came only from me. At worst, the statement might strike the average listener as wildly grandiose. But the good news is the idea isn't mine. As we've just heard, it comes from our boss, our commander-in-chief, if you will. You are the salt of the earth. Jesus says to his disciples, you are the light of the world. You have to admit it, it's an extraordinary claim, particularly in light of the unique characteristics of salt and light. And we'll come back to those two in just a moment. But maybe the most extraordinary part of this unlikely status is that we don't have to do anything to achieve it. We don't have to earn the right to be salt. We don't have to generate or spend energy of our own to be the light. In Jesus' way of seeing the world, that's just who we are. It's not in our nature. It is our nature. And you think, what, little old me? The salt of the earth? The light of the world? Really? Me? Yes, you. Little old you. And me. And all of us together. But how can this be, you might ask? What does that even mean? You are the salt of the earth. and the light of the world. It sounds so fancy. Well, I think we might find the answer to that question in the condition the world was in when Jesus spoke these words. In the gospel record that I just read a moment ago in Matthew's gospel, Jesus makes this claim at the beginning, toward the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, his first and, as I said, by far his most famous sermon, perhaps the most famous sermon ever preached. The words immediately, these words, "You are the light of the world, salt of the earth, the light of the world," these words immediately follow the Beatitudes. Blessed are the poor. Blessed are the peacemakers. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. Prior to this moment, there was simply no precedent for a community that understood itself this way. Not in Judea, not anywhere. It's clear, it seems, that in preaching the sermon and making these claims, Jesus intended to originate something completely new. To borrow from the great preacher and commentator Tom Long, he is establishing a colony of heaven, an outpost, really, set down in an alien culture, a foretaste of what was to come, a vision of God's realm. In a violent world, the members of this community are peacemakers. In a world filled with sorrow, as Tom Long notes, they mourn for the homeless, for the lost, for the refugee, for the brokenhearted. It was exactly the kind of colony the world needed desperately then. And in case you haven't been reading the news lately, it's exactly the kind of colony and community the world needs now. But I think an obvious question follows. Given the scale of what's happening out in the wider world at present, what difference could this small colony make? What is the point of an alternative community if the dominant culture around it is so dominant? The question reminds me of a lyric that Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote for his recent smash hit musical. In a moment of brutal candor, General George Washington admits to his trusted aide, Alexander Hamilton, after whom the musical is named, "We're outgunned, outmanned, outnumbered, outplanned." I'm pretty sure Jesus was aware that this same thing was true for him and his followers relative to their Roman overlords. They were indeed outgunned, outmanned, outnumbered, outplanned. Which may give us our answer as to why he says what he does about us, about his disciples. "You are the salt of the earth," he says, "not the soil. You are the light of the world, not the air." And that brings us back to the inherent qualities of salt and light. Let's say you've just made a pot of soup. You started with 2 quarts of water. You've added a bunch of fresh succulent vegetables. You have every reason to believe it's going to be absolutely delicious. But when you take that first taste, you're disappointed to discover that it's missing something. It's actually kind of bland. How much salt does it take to bring a batch of soup to life, to add vibrancy to the pot, to make the water and those vegetables together sing, as it were? This much? This much? Nope. How much? Just a pinch, right? Maybe 2 fingers worth of salt. Boom. That's all it takes. Or maybe more in keeping with how things feel out in the wider world right now. Let's suppose that to clear your head after listening to the news one night, you go out for a hike. You're not really used to doing this, but you just need to get out into nature. Let's suppose you get lost. Let's suppose that you are, in fact, inexperienced, and you brought no light, no matches. Now let's suppose it's February. Darkness falls. You have no idea where you are or how to get home. It was 45 degrees under sunny skies when you started. But now you see storm clouds are gathering as the sun begins to set. The temperature, you can feel it, the temperature is starting to plummet. You begin to panic. And for good reason, all you brought was your down vest, not even a hat. If the vest gets wet, those down feathers get wet in the falling temperatures. You're dead. And now, it's beginning to rain. When you're still not home, 2 hours later, your spouse finally calls 911. A rescue team is sent out. These guys, these folks are pros. They gather at the rendezvous point, turn on their headlamps, and head out into the night, the four of them, in different directions, say. Then you see it, a little light flickering off in the distance. It's got to be more than a mile away still. Whoever's wielding that light is still so far off, there's no way they could hear you, even if you shouted at the tops of your lung, at the top of your lungs. And it's just a little flicker, is this beam at this point, a wavering dot of light cast by only one headlamp. But it's enough for you. You feel hope flutter up in your chest like a bird, like a little bird inside of you. If you turn your head even just a few degrees, you'll lose sight of it, that light, and the darkness that's all around you, this vast darkness, will instantly swallow you up again. So you train your eyes on that little light, on that dot, and you keep them zeroed in on it, and you head straight for it. An hour later, you're home, safe and warm, eating the soup your husband has kept simmering on the stove for you. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. We don't have to flavor the water in Lake Michigan to make a difference. We just have to make what's in that one pot of soup come alive. We don't have to flood the entire night with light. We just have to shine bright enough for one person, to find their way home. Because for that one person, that one little light can make the difference between finding their way home and freezing to death alone in the darkness. As many of you will know, Nick Kristoff is an op-ed writer for the New York Times. He's therefore a national-level thought leader, a man whose opinions are read by literally millions of people every week. It's a position of immense privilege and enormous influence. Imagine having your thoughts appear on the front page of the New York Times every week. He owes all of this to one small group of people whom his father met before Nick himself was even born. This group just happened to be comprised, wait for it, of the members of the First Presbyterian Church of Portland, Oregon. And it just so happens that one day in 1952, they decided that if they were indeed the light of the world, as Jesus claimed they were, then they owed it to the world not to hide that light under a bushel. They were going to let it shine. It was not necessarily an easy decision, what they had planned. The Soviet Union had aggressively claimed its share of the spoils after World War II, which is to say, the Soviets had already colonized much of Eastern Europe and had made it clear to the United States, their former ally in the fight against Hitler, that in the race for global domination, they were just getting started. The world came to know that period that followed as the Cold War, aptly named really as in the cold that comes when darkness falls. In this moment of gathering darkness, First Presbyterians' decision to let their light shine made all the difference for Nick's dad. The problem was that Vladislav Kristofowicz, as he was known then, was lost. He'd spied for the Soviets against the Nazis, but he was not himself a Russian national, not a Soviet. And the Soviets didn't want him, and he didn't particularly want them either. He was, in effect, a global refugee. Nobody wanted him, it seemed. Until the people of the First Presbyterian Church of Portland, Oregon, declared that they did. They officially sponsored his entry into this country. So with their support, Vladislav Christofowitz boarded a ship bound for the United States. As Nick himself tells it, his son, when the ship approached New York Harbor, a white-haired lady from Boston chatted with him and quoted the famous lines from the Statue of Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. Problem with this is that Nick's dad spoke little English, and it was clear he didn't fully understand what this nice lady was saying. So she wrote the words down for him and handed him the piece of paper, saying, keep it as your souvenir, young man. Then, as she was walking away, she corrected herself, turned back. Keep it as a souvenir, young American. As Nick writes, my dad kept that scrap of paper and marveled that he, a refugee who had repeatedly faced death in the old country for not belonging, now somehow counted as an American, even before he had set foot on American soil, even before he had learned English. It was an inclusiveness that dazzled him, that kindled a love for America that he passed on to his son, to Nick. That strand of hospitality, he continues, represents the best of this country. It also represents, if I may say, the best of the church. First Presbyterian Church sponsored Christofowitz even though he wasn't a Presbyterian, even though he was Eastern European at the time, at a time when the communist bloc posed a direct threat to the United States. He could have been a spy. He could have been a terrorist. A couple of weeks ago, Nick Christoff flew back to Portland to meet with the congregation. They were, it turns out, thinking once again of sponsoring a refugee, and they had some questions for him, which he was glad to answer. But mostly, he simply wanted to thank them for what they had done for his father. Were there risks in bringing him to this country, they asked? Yes, there were. Did it solve the larger problems the world was facing at the tumultuous moment in history? No, they didn't. No, it didn't. Did it solve the global refugee problem in 1952? No, it did not. This one case didn't even make a dent in it, really. A literal sort of drop in the bucket, if that. But as Nick put it, it was completely transformative for the Christoff family. Completely transformative. You are the salt of the earth, Jesus says. You, all of us together, are the light of the world.